which is to open doors and windows out into all the realm of life. And I present to you now for his inaugural address as a member of the faculty of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, Dr. Leo T. Crispin, who has served as assistant librarian of the seminary beginning in 1937, and then became the librarian 9 years ago in 1951. Dr. Crispin is a native of Missouri, a graduate of William Jewell College. He holds the THM and PhD degrees from this seminary and the Master of Science in Library Science from Columbia University. We are proud of Dr. Crispin, and we listen gladly as he delivers his address on the subject, Making an Ideal Live. Dr. Crispin.
Dr. Cole, members of the faculty, student body, visitors, the earliest use to which the invention of inscribed or written signs was put was probably to record important religious and political transactions. These records would naturally be preserved in sacred places, and accordingly, the earliest libraries of the world were probably temples, and the earliest librarians priests. That is a quotation from Encyclopedia Britannica. The Apostle Paul, in prison in Rome, in writing to Timothy, asked for a material thing, his cloak, to keep him warm in the cold dungeon. Other things for which he made request cannot be so clearly classed with material. He asked for the books and the parchments. The cloak was material, but he, though spiritual, needed it. The books were not worldly, material only, they were spiritual. It is difficult to determine what he meant by the books, but it can fairly certainly be determined that the parchments meant the Old Testament, or portions of it, or even early parts of the New Testament. Jerome, the translator of the Latin Vulgate, was forced to leave Rome when a young woman who followed his ascetic practices died, perhaps from prolonged fastings and penances. He went to the east and settled near Bethlehem in 386 A.D. and built a monastery, a convent, a church, and a hospice, and settled down for the remainder of his life in a hermit's cell. In a letter written later, he says, "Many years ago, for the sake of the kingdom of heaven, I cut myself off from home, parents, sister, relations, and what was harder, from the dainty food to which I had been used. But even when I was on my way to Jerusalem to fight the good fight there, I could not bring myself to forego the library," and he used the word bibliotheca in Latin, "which with great care and labor I had gotten together at Rome." Now, if I could stop here with Jerome, I'd have a better argument for the library, but I must state that Jerome later condemned himself for reading more widely than from the sacred scriptures. The Apostle Paul evidently thought differently about the matter, and that he wanted not only the parchment, the sacred writings, but the books, a more general designation. Paul's writings show that he was widely read, not only in sacred writings, but also in the general literature of his time. In the ancient world, the 2nd and 1st centuries B.C., there were two great libraries, one at Pergamum, the other at Alexandria, competing for size and importance. Papyrus was the cheaper, more popular writing material of the time. Alexandria, in order to gain an advantage, placed an embargo on the export of papyrus from Egypt. Pergamum retaliated by developing and making more readily available the skins of animals, which to that time had been very expensive to use. In 41 B.C., the Pergamum Library contained 200,000 rolls. When the Romans under Antony conquered Asia Minor, Antony took the Pergamum Library and gave it to Cleopatra of Egypt, so that it went to increase the size of the Alexandrian Library, which had been founded between 300 and 290 B.C. It is said that under the Ptolemies, the library grew to 700,000 rolls. It was for this collection that the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures called the Septuagint was made, according to the story told by Josephus. A part of this library was destroyed at the time of Julius Caesar, 48-47 B.C. Edward Gibbon states that the Christians destroyed the remaining part of it in 4th century, 391 A.D. Others attribute its destruction to the Saracens in 646 A.D.
If we had that library today, we should have many classic texts not now available, and it would contribute greatly to our knowledge of the ancient world. Shakespeare calls all the world a stage. John speaks of the possibility of all the world as a library, and he says that if there were a library that large, it would not contain the written records of all Jesus did. There is question whether he meant that the world in the moral sense could not contain the books that should be written, or that all the libraries in the world could not contain them, or that the world itself could not contain them. Henry Ward Beecher, in regard to the loss of ancient records, has written, "When John says, 'And there are also many other things which Jesus did, the which, if they should be written every one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that should be written,' it affects me more profoundly than when I think of the destruction of the Alexandrian library or the perishing of Grecian art in Athens or Byzantium. The first imperial library in which Christian literature was probably admitted was one established at Constantinople by Constantine. At the death of Constantine in 337 AD, the number of books which had been brought together was only about 6,900 volumes. But it grew under the patronage of the successors of Constantine, and at the death of Theodosius in 450 AD, the library is said to have contained 100,000 volumes. About 250 AD, a church library was established at Jerusalem, and it became the rule to attach to every church a collection necessary for the inculcation of Christian doctrine." That's quotation from Britannica. So our church library movement's not entirely new. "During the 6th and 7th centuries, the learning which had been driven from the continent took refuge in the British Islands. In the Irish monasteries, during this period, there appears to have been many books, and the Venerable Bede was superior to any scholar of his age." In America, we find the first libraries in the colonies, apart from private libraries, were college libraries, and that they were largely made up of religious materials, since the colleges were established primarily to train ministers. Harvard College was found in 1638 in order not, I'm quoting, "to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present ministers shall lie in the dust," end quote. Rhode Island College, later Brown University, was founded in 1764 by the Baptists in order to secure for their churches an educated ministry without the restriction of denominational influences and sectarian tests. Harvard, Yale, and Brown were named for donors to their library. I'm quoting now from Lewis Shores in Origin of American College Libraries. "Significantly enough, American higher education began with a library. 2 years after the grant of £400 from the Massachusetts General Court establishing the first college in America, the Reverend John Harvard of Charleston gave by his will the sum of £779 in money and more than 300 volumes. As far as we know, these 300 books became the first higher educational property in America and rendered possible the immediate organization of the college on the footing of the ancient institutions of Europe, from which, out of gratitude to Harvard, the General Court voted that the new institution should bear his name." Yale College was named for Elihu Yale of the East India Company, who became interested in the college to the extent of giving 40 volumes and lending his name to the institution. Earlier in 1699, 10 ministers had met and had brought a number of books together, and laying them on the table, each had said, "I give these books for the founding of a college in this colony." The collection consisted of only about 40 volumes. Rhode Island College, in which such noted men as Morgan Edwards in America and John Gill in England were interested, was founded in 1764. The name was changed to Brown University in 1804, primarily because of contributions of John Brown, treasurer of the college, his younger brother Moses Brown, and in later years Nicholas Brown, to the library of the school. Columbia University in New York City was founded as King's College in 1754, and the library was begun in the same year. The school and the library were located in the vicinity of Trinity Church at Wall Street. When the Revolutionary War came on, the library was deposited in the City Hall. When the British took the city in September 1776, soldiers broke into the city hall and plundered it of the Columbia College Library. Because of a proclamation of a British officer, some of the books were restored. And again, I'm quoting from Lewis Shores. No one knows just how many volumes were restored at that time, but 30 years later, several hundred volumes were discovered in a room in St. Paul's Chapel. That's a little farther north on Broad Street from the Trinity Church area. Many stories were fabricated about mysterious doorways which had protected the books all these years. Said the Morning Chronicle, December the 13th, 1802, communication. A report prevailed a few days past of a splendid library having been found in the part of the chancel of St. Paul's Church by the workmen employed in preparing a place for the organ. It was supposed to have originally belonged to Columbia College and to have been locked up and forgotten ever since the Revolution. On investigating the matter, however, it was found to be a hoax invented by some wag to quiz the natives a few. I don't know exactly what that statement means. The report had gained so much by traveling that it was said a librarian was discovered with the library. who, on coming out into the city, was quite surprised with the changes that had taken place. Lewis Shores goes on, in spite of the witticism, it was proved that Columbia's books were found among 2,000 volumes resurrected in St. Paul's. How they got there, no one knew, but it was generally believed that they were placed there for safety during the war and forgotten after. The first census of the United States was that of 1790, and the returns were made to Philadelphia or Washington, wherever the capital was when the returns were completed, and deposited in the Library of Congress. Later, most of these were published in volumes entitled Heads of Family in Virginia and so forth, 1790, for the various states. I have often needed to make use of the Kentucky volume of that census, but it is not in the series, because the Kentucky materials were, quote, destroyed when the British burned the capital at Washington during the War of 1812. I admit that the first time I learned that, it rather angered me. There are two former British subjects on my library committee, Dr. Russ and Dr. Peterson. On August 24, 1814, Washington was captured by the British and the capital was consumed by fire, with the books of the Library of Congress being used as kindling. Now I'm quoting from Mearns in the History of the Library of Congress. Indignation at destruction so wanton and so uncivilized was widespread. The British soldiers were compared favorably with the Mohammedans who had destroyed the Alexandrian Library. They were Vandals, Barbarians, Goths, and all other names which always are applied to the enemies of culture. However, the Americans had forgotten the conduct of American troops at York, the present Toronto, in 1813. I visited Toronto in June of 1959 and saw the restored old Fort York, which was first founded in 1793. On April 27, 1813, the American troops, under the command of General Zebulon M. Pike, for whom Pike's Peak in Colorado is named, made an attack on Fort York. General Pike was killed, but his soldiers were victorious, and during the following night, they proceeded to raid the town. They set fire to the Parliament building and destroyed a part of the library. They also carried off the Upper Canada Mace, the symbol of authority, and this remained in the United States at Washington until President Franklin D. Roosevelt restored it in 1934 during the Toronto Centenary. In 1849, James T. Boyce was considering whether to attend the Baptist Theological School at Hamilton, New York, or Princeton Seminary. And quoting from Broadus, he inquired particularly about the extent and value of the library at Hamilton, in which respect Princeton then doubtless greatly excelled. Few patrons of higher education appreciate the value of a great library in attracting the more aspiring students and in promoting breadth of culture. Dr. Boyce chose Princeton and was a student at Princeton from 1849 to 1851. In a chapel address on February 5, 1957, I pointed out that no less a person than Bishop Hugh Latimer of England was keeper of the small but growing collection of books in the Cambridge University Library between 1506 and 1529. The presidents of some of the schools have been librarians of the school. At Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, Dr. Boyce assumed personal responsibility for directing the building up of the library. After his death in 1888, 5,000 volumes from the theological section of his library were combined with the seminary library. In purchasing books for the seminary and for himself, Dr. Boyce had kept this ultimate intention in mind so that the two collections were in a remarkable degree complementary. Dr. John R. Sampley, who later became president, states in his memoirs that in May 1890, he was, quote, appointed to rearrange and to recatalog the library, end quote. He was made librarian in 1891. The library at Greenville, the building occupied by the seminary in 1859, was the abandoned house of worship of the First Baptist Church at Greenville, South Carolina. This building was erected in 1826 and had been abandoned by the congregation in 1857 when the present auditorium was erected. The picture published in the history of the First Baptist Church of Greenville in 1957 was of a drawing of this building. No one there at that time knew of a photograph which had been preserved and which is in our library at the present time. This early building measured about 28 to 40 feet, so this became the first home of the seminary library. Broadus states that the building was divided by partitions into two lecture rooms and a library. The library collection began with about 2,000 volumes from the library of the Furman Theological Institution. The worth of the collection was estimated at $2,000. Reference was made to an expenditure for the purchase of books not to exceed $500 annually. The second home, the seminary library, was in the Public Library Hall, or Polytechnic Building, on 4th Street in Louisville, where the Kaufman Strauss Building now stands. Broadus states that Boyce rented lecture rooms and a library room on the third and fourth stories. A letter dated February the 14th, 1944, from John W. Loving of Edgewood, Texas, states that he, with hired help, had the honor and labor of transferring the library from the third floor of the old Polytechnic Building to the fourth floor of New York Hall. A manuscript catalog of the books in the library during the session of 1879-80 still exists, with designations as to the case and shelf for each title. Here the seminary library, with about 7,000 volumes in 1877, was in the same building with the Public Library of Louisville, or the Polytechnic Society Library, with about 30,000 volumes. In 1888, the seminary library had 15,000 volumes, and the Polytechnic Society about 40,000 volumes. This latter society was the predecessor of the Louisville Free Public Library. Some books with the Polytechnic Society stamp on them are now in our collection, however stamped, discarded by the Louisville Free Public Library. I picked up an indication that there were some books published, a few books purchased for the library during these years. In June 1884, Dr. Boyce wrote to Broadus, "I intended to warn you lest you should purchase any books for the library this summer. I am anxious to cut down seminary expenses." There is no way to determine the size of the room occupied by the seminary library in the Polytechnic Building. A description of the building appears in the history of the Louisville Free Public Library. Since enrollment of the seminary was 89 in 1877 and 157 in 1888, seating for 20 to 25 students would have been considered adequate. A room 35 or 40 feet square would have been necessary to contain the books and provide reading and work area. The third location of the library was at 5th and Broadway. At this location, the library was first housed in New York Hall, which was on the east side of 5th Street, just south of where the bus depot stands at the present time. And again, I'm quoting from the letter of J.W. Loving. He says, "There was no elevator, so it all had to be done by main strength and awkwardness, and the ladder was not too little. We had elevators over in this new library, and there's still plenty of awkwardness manifested in the handling of the materials. Plans for the first floor of the New York Hall in 1886-87 catalog show a library space totaling about 2,540 square feet, with about 800 square feet as reading area and about 1,000 square feet for stacks. In the 1830s and 40s, there grew up in Louisville a young woman by the name of Sarah Julia Guthrie. She was one of three daughters of James Guthrie, who was Secretary of the Treasury under President Franklin Pierce, President of the Louisville Nashville Railroad, and United States Senator from Kentucky. Sarah Julia Guthrie became a Christian and was baptized into the fellowship of Walnut Street Baptist Church on June the 7th, 1851. On June the 24th, 1852, she married J. Lawrence Smith, a teacher in the School of Medicine at the University of Louisville. This couple never had any children. The two other Guthrie daughters became Mrs. John Caperton and Mrs. William B. Caldwell. Each had two children. Sarah Julia Caperton and Mary Elizabeth Caperton were born to her sister, Mrs. John Caperton, and William Beverly Caldwell and Lawrence Smith Caldwell were born to the sister, Mrs. William B. Caldwell. Of these children, one lived to be 29 years old, one 23, another 17. The other died at a still earlier age. No one of them ever married. When the last one of her nephews and nieces died in 1888, Mrs. J. Lawrence Smith announced to Dr. Broadus that she planned to give $50,000 to the seminary for the erection of a library building as a memorial to them. On October 17, 1888, Broadus wrote to Boyce, who was then in Europe. The same day came quite a remarkable appointment of Providence. I called in the afternoon on Mrs. J. Lawrence Smith. She said that by coincidence, she herself was just figuring when I came in to see her what property was available to sell for $50,000, which she proposed to give to the seminary for a library building as a memorial of her two nieces and of William and Lawrence Crowell. Much has been said about the $50,000 gift of Governor Joseph Emerson Brown of Georgia in 1880 because it came at such a critical period in the life of the seminary. In an article in the Western Reporter after the death of Mrs. Smith in 1901, Dr. T.T. Eaton stated, "She was the largest giver to the theological seminary." In 1899, Dr. Eaton in his History of Walnut Street Church said, "It was in the fall of 1888 that Mrs. J. Lawrence Smith, already one of the largest givers to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, gave $50,000 for a memorial library building." However, records in the Treasurer's office show that perhaps the George W. Norton family had given more money at that time, a total of about $85,000 at that time, and Dr. and Mrs. Smith had given $68,000, Joseph Emerson Brown $59,000. Dr. Eaton in 1901 wrote further in regard to her, "Being the daughter of the Honorable James Guthrie, she had every advantage of education and of the best society. Being the wife of, perhaps, the greatest scientist America has produced, she was welcomed and honored at the capitals of Europe by the wise and the great. Thus, to her natural gifts was added the rarest culture, but she did not in the slightest degree lose sympathy with the humblest. Her consideration for the comfort and convenience of others, even the lowliest, was wonderful. She was modest almost to a fault. She held the humblest opinion of herself, and all flattery was distasteful, although I never knew anyone more grateful for any kindness shown." This building was completed and dedicated in May 1891. A marble plaque, which was built in the interior of that building, has been preserved and is displayed at the library at the present time, along with a picture of the building also. The library, while in this building, during the time Dr. Sampi was called librarian, from 1891 to 1928, was served by the following who were called assistant librarians: Edgar Allen Forbes from 1897 to 1904, John Moncur to about 1907, James Henry Coleman to about 1911, M. McFarland from 1910 to 1961. I had a letter from Mr. McFarland just the other day. Thomas A. Johnson, assistant librarian, July the 1st, 1916 to June the 1st, 1929, and called librarian from 1929 until his death in 1939. At this time, a movement was launched to raise $50,000 for the endowment of the Library Book Fund as a memorial to John A. Broadus. Dr. Sampi states in his memoir that this fund was increased to $8,000 in 1895 and 96. The endowment fund now stands at $14,400. During the session 1899-1900, Theodore Harris of Louisville gave $500 for the purchase of scientific books and an additional $500 to endow the collection. The income from that fund is to be used to purchase scientific books from year to year, designated with a book plate, Harris Scientific Collection. While the seminary was on 4th Street and at 5th and Broadway, the catalog in its statement about the library always included further facilities for research afforded by the Public Library of Louisville and other public and private libraries in the city, ranged from a total of 50,000 volumes in 1877 to more than 100,000 in 1925. That was dropped out of the catalog after we moved out here because the students were considered not close enough to make use of those materials. In 1918, it was stated that most of the standard books on religious subjects were being purchased as they came from the press. Many collections still have been received, but they serve to build up collections, fill in gaps, or supply duplicates rather than to afford working materials for current issues. There have been times when some faculty members have gotten the impression that if they recommended a book for purchase at the library, they had better be prepared to defend their action in so doing. Faculty members, instructors, and even the more observing students should be encouraged to recommend books for purchase and to make suggestions as to the method of the operation of the library. Some very valuable classical works came from Gessner Harrison through the Broadus and Robertson families. Gessner Harrison was professor of Greek at the University of Virginia, and he was the father of the first wife of John A. Broadus. She was the mother of Miss Eliza Broadus, who was still living when I came to Louisville in 1930. I remember her injury and death from being hit by a car at Lexington Road and Stills Avenue in 1931. Ella Broadus Robertson, the daughter of Dr. Broadus from a second marriage, died from injuries sustained at the same street intersection in 1945. From the Gessner Harrison collection, we secured an edition of the Pseudis Greek Lexicon from the 10th century in parts that was published along the 1850s. I was taught that the Greek alphabet began with alpha and ended with omega. In one of these sections, I found the words beginning with omega before the end of the work, and I thought that something was wrong, but upon investigation I found that the compilers of the lexicon treated omega as related to omicron and therefore placed omega directly after omicron, and the work ended with psi rather than omicron. I remember a story told by A.T. Robertson about Gessner Harrison on a Greek examination at the University of Virginia. Dr. Harrison failed nearly all of the students, and those who failed were asked to come to his office. After the interviews, they all came out downcast and discouraged, but one of them was noticed to be happy and smiling, and when he was asked why he had such a different attitude, he replied that Dr. Harrison had told him that of all those who failed, he came the nearest to passing. It was in this period, 1876, that Dr. Sampi states that he introduced the duodecimal system as a method of cataloging the library books. He was made librarian. I've got the wrong date there. Someone doesn't know. They don't have got there. He was made librarian in May 1891. When Dr. Sampi introduced this cataloging scheme in 1890, the method was only about 14 years old, since the first publication of the system was in 1876. Prior to that, the books seemed to have been arranged generally by subject and placed in cases with the case and shelf numbered and with those numbers indicated on the books. Larger libraries, however, needed a scheme of classification. A popular method in the 19th century was that adopted by Francis Bacon in dividing the areas of knowledge into memory, reason, and imagination. Memory included history, natural science, and technology. Reason included philosophy, religion, law, mathematics. And imagination included fine arts, architecture, painting, sculpture, music, and so forth. This was a system generally used by Thomas Jefferson in the library, which was purchased from him to form the nucleus of the new Library of Congress after the destruction by the British in 1814. Dr. Sampi made a wise choice in the duodecimal classification. A committee for our library in 1954 made a study of the existing systems, and we decided that Dewey had as few faults as any other, or none of them is perfect, but adopting a system and working with it in its development is essential. I try to wait until the system expands to make expansion and to find a place for all materials in the system without introducing new categories until the responsible persons introduce the categories. To go it alone is wasteful and at times ridiculous. At a meeting of the American Theological Library Association Union Theological Seminary in New York City in June 1955, Miss Julia Petit stated that when she came to Union Seminary Library in 1909 at the request of Dr. W.R. Rockwell, a librarian, to reclassify that collection and to work out what became the Union Seminary classification system, she found there in use a division worked out by a previous librarian called Minor Morals. And under this classification, there were subdivisions: profanity, drunkenness, women, dueling, war, and so forth. When the seminary, including the library, outgrew facilities at 5th and Broadway, new buildings were erected at the beaches, 2825 Lexington Road. The northwest wing of Norton Hall, occupied the library in 1926, was designated as Memorial Library, and a bronze plaque was mounted on the reading room wall with the wording of the marble plaque displayed in the 5th and Broadway building. Although no new money from the Mrs. J. Lawrence Smith family or related sources was received. With the death of Dr. Mullins on November 23, 1928, and the election of Dr. Sampey as president, a reorganization of the library was necessary. Dr. Sampey relinquished the title of librarian, and it was given to Thomas A. Johnson, June 1, 1929, after 13 years of service. He remained in this position until his death in 1939. W. Hersey Davis was given something of the oversight formerly exercised by Dr. Sampey, and he was called chief librarian from October 1928 to June 1st. Him to leave Louisville. An interesting account can be given in regard to the Greek manuscript of the Gospels at present in the collection. A letter dated March the 2nd, 1927, which you will find on display over the library, came to Dr. Robertson from Dr. Adolf Deismann of Berlin, Germany. In it, Dr. Deismann described this Gospel manuscript, and he said that it had come from Asia Minor, he thought, and that, quote, it turned up during or after the horrible expulsion of the Greeks in 1922. He suggested that in view of the small number of Greek codices in America, this one would be of value to our seminary library. And he stated that he would like to have it for his New Testament seminar, but a generous patron in 1910 had supplied him with one. So he was giving Dr. Robertson the first opportunity to purchase the book. The price with a modern binding was $700. Dr. Robertson wanted the manuscript, but no library funds were available. Dr. Mullins was the president, Dr. Sampey was the librarian. Previously, he had wanted more copies of Tischendorf's Novum Testamentum Graecae, 8th edition major. We're told that Dr. Sampey said for him to get out and raise the money, so it seems that he would have to do the same thing to get the prized Gospel manuscript. However, he was not in suspense very long, for a student in his graduate class, John Wick Bowman, who at that time was professor of New Testament in Presbyterian Mission Seminary in India, became interested and persuaded his father and his brother and their wives. They provided the $700 and purchased the manuscript and gave it to the library. In this library, the theological materials are more fully developed. When I was a student, the class in systematic theology met 4 days a week, when New Testament, Greek, Old Testament, Hebrew, and so forth met only 3 days a week. To justify that, Dr. Tribble used to say, after all, this is a theological seminary. We have been working on the theological collection for a century. However, the materials for the religious education section have been building up over many years. The section on music is the newest, although a nucleus developed by Dr. Broadus and Dr. Basil Manley Jr., who were interested, has been expanding slowly for a long time. In recent years, with the organization of the School of Church Music, there has been a marked growth of that collection. An adequate library support ought to be received consistently so that there will not be gaps in the collection which cannot be filled or can be filled only at great expense. In 1937, the library received from the family of Dr. Charles A. Stakely of Montgomery, Alabama, 1,000 volumes from his library. Although there were many duplications, this was a very valuable addition to the library. In working through the collection, Dr. Johnson found the portion of a marriage license which Dr. Stakely should have returned to the county clerk or recorder at one of his pastorates. Dr. Johnson returned it to it, to the proper county official, who acknowledged receipt of it and stated that both parties of the marriage were dead, but he would file it in its proper place. Librarians in 1939 were very much disturbed at the retirement of Herbert Putnam as Librarian of Congress after 40 years of service. President Roosevelt appointed Archibald MacLeish, who was not a trained or experienced librarian, to succeed him. Mr. Roosevelt was charged with using the office of Librarian of Congress as a political pawn. However, Mr. MacLeish did not last long at the job to which he had been appointed without being equipped for the position. He resigned in 1944 to become an assistant secretary of state. Abraham Lincoln fell into that same trap in regard to the Librarian of Congress. John S. Meehan, the only Baptist Librarian of Congress, as far as I can determine, served from 1829 to 1861. He had grown old in the service, and on May the 24th, 1861, soon after Mr. Lincoln came into office, he removed him from office. In this act, it was said that Mr. Lincoln was, quote, not indifferent to political considerations, end quote. The man whom he appointed as Librarian of Congress, John S. Stevenson of Terre Haute, Indiana, did not last long, for toward the end of 1864, quote, he found employment elsewhere in the government, end quote. The position of librarian in a seminary ought not to be used as a theological plum to increase the salary or authority or prestige of someone whom the administration desires to honor. Mr. Raymond P. Morris in 1933 pointed out that the term librarian, as applied to theological library staffs, was misleading, and that members of the faculty were designated as librarians, but that Mr. Morris, in making his survey for the volumes of The Education of American Ministers, said he had to go to the assistant libraries or even to secretaries in some instances to get information about the libraries. The men designated librarians were not doing the work of the librarian. This can no longer be justified and was continued in some institutions far beyond a reasonable period. With the development of 35-millimeter microfilm as a method of reproducing library materials, the library soon acquired film even before it had a reader. The earliest film secured was out of the minutes of the Muscle Shoals Baptist Church in South Kentucky. The filming was done as a WPA project. With that purchase in 1940, the library fell in with the present reversion to the old style of book, the roll, which went out of use in the second and third centuries. Albert Bonney, an advocate of microprint or microcards as opposed to microfilm, chides librarians in the use of microfilm for going back to the, quote, centuries-old form of the scroll, end quote. Planning for the James P. Boyce Centennial Library extended from October 1956 to June 1958. The groundbreaking ceremony was conducted on May the 24th, 1957. The basic contract for the erection of the building was let on June the 25th, 1958, and construction was started early in July. Contracts for equipment and decoration were let in March 1959. The cornerstone laying ceremony was observed on May the 20th, 1959. The building was completed in November the 10th and 11th, marked the removal of the books from the old library to the new. The present James P. Boyce Centennial Library is the sixth building occupied by the library, and it has been planned to serve for 50 to 100 years. It measures 175 feet by 100 feet with four levels and a total of 76,000 square feet of floor space. Its total stack capacity ranges from 225,000 volumes with a seating capacity of 650 chairs or more. The Carver School Library is now contained in its spacious quarters at the south end of the second floor, and coordination of the work necessary to maintain the collections and of the services rendered by them is being perfected. New facilities provided by the new building include seminar rooms where advanced students meet to use materials related to the library, the Dean's Lecture Hall, designed for special lectures and for projection of films, small classrooms to accommodate summer session classes, music listening rooms, and rooms for studying music materials, special studies for faculty members and advanced students, and the Heritage Room. And large facilities are provided in many areas, especially in graduate study carrels, the audiovisual aids, binding and repair of books, wrapping and shipping of materials, and storage. Time has gone into planning, effort has gone into building, and money has gone both to these and to other purpose, because it is a conviction of the faculty of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary that the library is the intellectual central power plant of the Theological Seminary, and that it must be sensitive to the expansion of any teaching unit of the institution. The purpose of the library is to collect materials of a theological or religious nature to meet the instructional demands of the institution of which it is a part. The further purpose is to provide a place for the use of these materials in their ever-expanding forms and to give motivation in the utilization of them. Service performed by the library extends to students, faculty, local interests, Southern Baptists, and the persons interested in learning, wherever they may be or whatever may be their status.
We thank you, Dr. Chrisman, for this very interesting and stimulating address. We're going to close this service with a benediction.